I'm Catherine Mengue Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason, and today I'm delighted to present a very special edition of the Reason podcast. The panel you're about to hear is about criminal justice reform, the prospects for meaningful political discourse in a polarized age, and how to talk to people who think you're completely evil. It's also 100% women. We are 4 for 4 on uteruses on this panel. Joining me for today's distaff discussion are Helen Fisher, who's a biological anthropologist, a fellow at the Kinsey Institute, an advisor to Match.com, and the author of several books about gender and the way our brains work. Lynn Ulbricht, who is an activist, speaker, and the mother of Ross Ulbricht, who is serving life in prison for his role in running the Silk Road website. And Heidi Boghossian, the co-host of Law and Disorder, a great podcast about criminal justice. She's also the executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute. This estrogen-packed panel was recorded at Reason's Donor Weekend in West Palm Beach, Florida. So first, what I want to talk about is, as is not too often the case in a panel like this one, not all of you are libertarians or would identify as libertarians. So I'd like to just start with, how did you end up on this stage? And I think that answer can be either biographical or ideological. I'd love to start with you, Lynn.
Yeah, well, first of all, I took that test, you know, where do you stand politically? And I came out very libertarian a long time ago, but I'm here because of my new identity, apparently, from 4 years ago when Ross is arrested as Ross Ulbricht's mother. I've been called on Twitter Dread Mother Roberts, which I'm not adopting, but in any case, with Ross's arrest, I was catapulted into this strange world of cryptocurrency, dark net, criminal justice, and have had a very steep learning curve. But what I've come out of it with is seeing up close and personal what the government, what the criminal justice system is doing in our country. And it's frankly terrifying. And once you take the red pill, you can't untake the red pill. And I've seen it. And I need to speak out about it, not only on Ross's behalf, but just for our future and for our children's future, which sort of touches on what Melissa was saying. So that's how I got here. Oh, and Heidi is a libertarian process. I brought her here. She's a libertarian process.
Yes, I do share many libertarian values. I came because I wrote one of the amicus briefs in the Ulbricht case, and I'm long been interested in cases involving government overreaching of individuals who I think are standing up for a better society. It's really an honor to be here. I want to be more involved. I might soon be the 8th or 9th libertarian in New York City.
Jerry's house is getting crowded.
But I really care a lot about, I've been touched recently and offended greatly by the extent that political correctness has been rampant on college campuses and has stifled free speech. And I'm basically for individual rights over government censorship and control.
Well, I ran into the 6 libertarians in New York City, and they invited me. Well, that's about it.
You know, you should never go where libertarians invite you, just for the record. It's typically not a good policy. No, actually, it's a great policy. We have good parties. So the thing that I want to talk about in this podcast is how we talk. I want to talk about communication, because I think that's something that historically... and in fact, I think we saw it in its best possible form on the man panel that preceded us, which is how we should refer to all male panels, the man panel. The man panel that preceded us, which was, it was incredibly informative, it was incredibly information dense, it conveyed a bunch of ideas systematically arranged in a very neat and tidy way. And that's a form of communication that works very, very well for some people, but it doesn't work well for everyone. And I think on this stage, we have people who are both theoretical experts in communication and also have a lot of practical experience in how to tell a story about libertarianism, about freedom, about why it's important in a way that, a different way than just the kind of systematic laying out of the principle. So One thing I wanted to ask Heidi in particular is, you mentioned to me before this panel that the role of kind of independent media and in particular podcasting in how you do your work and how you communicate your values. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? And maybe you could also just talk a bit about the Law and Disorder podcast, which I think is something people in this room would like to know about.
Yes. Law and Disorder is a podcast that was formed a couple of years after the attacks of 9/11 by New York attorney Michael Ratner, who was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And he had another New York attorney who was a member of the National Lawyers Guild, a progressive bar association that I was running at the time. They needed a woman. And I had an Armenian last name, so I brought some diversity, I think, to the show. But the goal was to tackle subjects like torture, extraordinary rendition, the encroaching, we called it, but now we say the police state, and to do it by interviewing every week activists, radical attorneys in the spirit of the Guild, people who had their own political views when they defended individuals or causes, usually people that were targeted by the government unjustly. Michael Ratner sadly passed away a couple of years ago, so Michael Smith and I have continued the show. We get two or three guests each week. We research topics that are timely, but try to tackle them from a different point of view, showing the individual stories, and also always having an element of action or hope so that we're critical. And what we do is elicit that, obviously, by researching the guests, the topic, and crafting questions that really elicit their stories from them. And we interview a lot of testosterone-filled people who are on the front lines, really challenging government overreaching and often taking unpopular stances. We do a lot on free speech, political correctness, but a lot on little known or little covered by the mainstream media topics. And I come at this from an interest in the underground newspapers from the 60s and 70s that really provided the possibility of an alternative message for individuals who might not have access to social justice movements that were shut down by both the FBI and the CIA, who justified infiltrating them, shutting them down based on the fact that they might be run by foreign agents. And I think that those newspapers had a vibrant, if short-lived, history and possibility of bringing about radical social change. Then we had pirate radio, low-power FM radio, and Law and Disorder is not just a podcast, but we are on over 100 radio stations, many of which are low-power. And I think those are critically important vehicles, as podcasts are now because of their portability, easy accessibility, to really bringing an alternative to the corporate-run mainstream media.
One thing I wanted to highlight was a recent episode you did with the Raging Grannies. Is that what they're called? Could you talk about that story as a sort of case study, I guess, in
yes.
the type of guest you have?
What we try to do is give examples of people who are defying the laws, engaging in civil disobedience, and standing up for what they believe in passionately. I run a small nonprofit that gives grants to activist groups around the globe. And we also house about 12 small groups, such as the War Resisters League, Grannies for Peace, a group of undocumented youth. We give them a communal space to work. And the grannies are in their 80s and 90s and have been going to protests, getting arrested. One of our guests is in her 80s and had been arrested, I think it was over 100 times. We think those are important examples for people to hear about as really champions of standing up for a government that doesn't impede what we think is important. So that was, we try to be age diverse and show that anything is possible if you do it on your own initiative.
One thing I thought was interesting about a guest you had in that episode was that she had been an activist and a radical in her youth, and then she had had a child and been a single mother, and said, I couldn't be arrested for 20 years. And when I, you know, my kid grew up and I retired, and I decided it was time to start getting arrested again. And I think that's an interesting
yes.
retirement plan, and I'm kind of considering it for myself. So right. anybody's taking
she
that.
She was a freedom rider in the 60s.
Yeah. So Lynn, obviously you have, you know, unfortunately, you are your own story. You and your son are your own story. You know, we talk a lot at Reason Magazine about finding the personal story to convey the bigger idea. The personal story found you in this case. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, you're part of the story, but you are also the messenger and the activist. How do you parse those two roles? And in particular, when you're on stage and you're talking about something very personal, you know, how do you know how much to bring to the audience in that moment? Or do you just let it happen?
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. I mean, people say you need to write a book. I'm like, I'm waiting to see how it turns out first. Yeah. I tend to be kind of private, so I had to learn how to tweet. One of the most challenging things I had to learn in this whole thing. And how much, you know, personal versus, you know, I more tend to want to talk about the facts and what the government's done. But I do think that because I have a direct experience, and I think what happens in podcasting and interviews is that your authenticity, if you're authentically talking about your experience, it's pretty hard to argue with it. And I think it comes across. And I think one of the powers of podcasting is it's kind of a conversation. It's not a speech. It's a conversation, really. And so I think that your own experience, my experience, for example, lends credibility, because I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen it, you know, and I know the families in the prisons. I've seen the prosecutors and what they've done. I've seen, you know, and so I can add to that experience with statistics and facts. But I think the power of it is the personal experience. So I try to blend that. And I think that that makes for, you know, a conversation that's interesting, kind of unique. I mean, and also because I'm not the typical anarchist, you know, I mean, and so I think there's a certain, oh, she's a mom and she's, you know, looks normal kind of, and, you know, that it adds a certain credibility to it that's different from maybe some others that are in the space, so.
Helen, one thing I was struck by in your work is your platinum rule to do unto others as they would do unto themselves. And I think that's particularly true when you're trying to argue for a cause or kind of communicate a goal. I was struck by your claim that some people respond to concrete examples and some people don't. Can you talk about that a little bit and how to parse that typology? Maybe how do you know when you're talking to someone who needs concrete examples?
Oh, that's interesting. I do want to follow up on part of this war. I do a lot of speeches, actually, about, in fact, Deloitte has borrowed my entire idea and has trained over 190,000 of their employees on how you walk into a room and size somebody up and then, you know, tell them what you got to say, but say it in a way that they can hear it. And I often give slides of how you talk to these different people. Now, for example, when I was researching Peter Thiel, well, I mean, the fact that he was a chess prodigy and a math whiz is a direct indication that he's very high on testosterone. If he had also been going constantly to the symphony, that's an indication. And when I try to size somebody up, I don't look at their achievements in life, you know, that they've gotten this degree or that. I look at, for example, Mike Pence. His BA was in history. Now, what is history? But it's a very detailed. It's not highly theoretical. Now, there's some historians who will say this is a theory to it, but it's already happened. You know, it's history. So it's not like you're going into the future. So that was my first tip-off that Mike Pence was probably very high serotonin. And so I will watch very carefully, even facial structure, the way they phrase their words, the words they choose, even what they're wearing, and of course what they do in their spare time. It's much more interesting. You know, I mean, I live in New York. I've got friends who go to Nantucket every summer. I got other people who are going to North Korea and then the highlands of New Guinea. Well, this will immediately tell you about somebody's neural structure. And so once you get to know the system, it actually can be quite simple. Now, you know, no two people are alike. And so I never am totally confident that I've gotten it right. But do you mind if I say something else about, and I, you two are both in a war. I'm in a war too. I am in academia. And in my part of academia, they do not like to talk about gender differences. And they certainly do not like to hear about four broad styles of thinking and behaving, because they don't like to hear about genetics. Mm-hmm. And I spent 5 years writing a book called The First Sex, The Natural Talents of Women and How They're Changing the World. And in this book, I went to great lengths to say that women's contextual long-term thinking is going to be useful in business, in the NGOs, their ability to read posture, gesture, tone of voice, their empathy, et cetera, can be a great attribute, and et cetera, et cetera. And that book was killed in 1 week by 11 feminists who wrote the most vicious appraisals of the book on Amazon. And 5 years of my work, this is not like your child or the government overreach, but it is a serious, as John Tierney was saying last night, war, left war on important parts of science.
One thing I actually wanted to ask all of you, but I'll start with you, Helen, is, that story obviously is very on point, but it seems like you haven't attained full Charles Murray status. You know, no one's actually throwing things at your head when you show up at college campuses, quite yet, at least. And I wonder...
Well, I hope my luck holds.
Me too. But I wonder, are there better and worse ways to talk about these topics that people don't want to hear about? And I think everyone on this stage does that to some extent. But in particular, in your case, you know, you've written several more books. I assume at least some of those were attempts to take some of that work and repackage it in a way that people could hear. Mm-hmm. Are there sort of takeaways on that?
Interesting. You know, a friend of mine who's a big businessman, he said, you know, the difference between academia and business is that in academia, you got a new idea, and they say, oh, that's interesting, prove it. And in business and politics, they all say, oh, that's interesting, how can we use it? So I've just gone around academia, to hell with them. They can sit there and rot. You know, I'm just gonna. You know.
And Heidi, in your work, I think, you know, you're often running up against, both a general bias in favor of law enforcement, right? That just exists in the world that people say, oh, you know, if the cops, you know, if you've been arrested, you've probably done something wrong. Like, this is an idea, or you shouldn't fear surveillance if you don't have anything to hide. And I think those sentiments are prevalent, and I suspect are something that you run up against a lot. In your work, when you're thinking about how to parse the difference between the demands of the law that sort of specific points are proven in a specific and formal way versus kind of people's underlying intuitive or moral feelings about lawbreaking. What language do you use, and do you have an example of a case where you took an unsympathetic central character or defendant and tried to kind of sell them to the your listeners?
It's critical to pull out the personal stories behind each character and their cause. One of the issues that I care a lot about is hackers, who I think have been really vilified by the government and all lumped together as enemies and thieves. I met Jeremy Hammond, who is currently serving 10 years in prison for hacking into a corporate site, a very altruistic young person from Chicago who was so smart, I think his IQ was over 170, who had in college uncovered a flaw in the computer system of University of Chicago, reported it to them, said he'd help them fix it, and instead he was kicked out. Individuals who come at a problem with a solution, but because they do it in an untraditional way, they are vilified, or as, and that's why I was attracted to the Ulbricht case. Ross was clearly extremely intelligent, innovative, and had an idea that just took off and was a great threat to the government. So I think it's important to go beyond the specific action and find the person's motivation, humanize them, and then point out how, in the case of hackers, it's very clear that this country spends an enormous amount of money after a software vulnerability is found, a great hack takes place. Companies don't like to report that because it makes them look bad, but it's really impinging on the entire integrity of our internet and computer structure and makes us vulnerable to more attacks. So I think you have to balance the human side with armed with facts and make your case about why we need to expand the way we traditionally think about things or are fed in the mainstream media and by government agencies to think.
One small illustration of that point is one of our most popular recent videos is about George Hotz. The Reason TV crew went and talked with a guy who he's a very classic garage hacker. He was, I think, the first or one of the first to jailbreak the iPhone. He's now trying to jury rig, I think with quite a bit of success, a self-driving car to sort of retrofit some of the most common models of cars for about $1,000 to turn them into self-driving vehicles. And his, the video about him, which featured his sort of scruffy-looking house and his team, which all, you know, they kind of had matching sweatshirts on, like the really cool kids. And I think, you know, using video as a medium to show this person who calls himself a hacker, who is a hacker for sure, and yet is so different than the kind of sinister Hollywood picture that we have of such people. And some of our other most popular videos have also been, a video about tiny houses, which was a longstanding big hit, as well as some coverage of Cody Wilson, who's a hacker in his own right and a printer of guns and a machiner of guns at home. Same thing, sort of seeing the faces of these guys and hearing them say, the reason I'm doing this is not because I'm the bad guy. The reason I'm doing this is because I think there's an important underlying principle at stake and I want to prove it out or I want to test it. I think the reputation of the hacker is one that still Reason certainly would like to reclaim a bit. Lynn, can you talk a little bit about in your experience, you know, I assume a significant percentage of the people that you encounter are just going to say, like, okay, but drugs are bad. You know, like there's got to be a sort of fundamental layer that you have to get through. And how do you break through that layer?
And also just for the former point, John Stossel's series on We Need the Rule Breakers, I think, is apt here too. You know, and he cited Ross and others. It's that's how we grow, and especially in the digital age, things are changing so quickly, and to punish them is retroactive. You know, it's just not constructive. But anyway, well, I have an advantage in that I'm a mom, and it's kind of a Teflon thing. You know, it's like you don't attack a mother. So I have been, I think, somewhat immune to being attacked. It's a little dangerous to do that, but at the same time, it's assumed I'm irrational. It's assumed I'm going to get up on a podium and start crying and just appeal to emotion and say, please feel sorry for me and my son. And I feel like it's what's really, and yeah, I have shed many tears, of course. But when I talk to people, I want to say, this affects you. This is an example of what can happen. It is not just about Ross. You don't know Ross. Why would you care for very long? But this is happening to all of us, and it's setting precedent. And I really try to get that across and be rational at the same time. And I also feel like it's very bipartisan. It's, you know, conservatives, I think, have sort of, can have a knee-jerk reaction to, oh, it's drugs, it's bad, drug war is good. And trying to have them understand, it's not, the drug war has nothing to do with drugs. Even the government would figure out after 45 years and over $1 trillion that it doesn't work if they really cared about stopping drug use. So it's about government expansion and money and power and decimating our constitutional rights. So I feel like that's a message I really want to start emphasizing more with the conservatives. The drug issue is not such a big deal with, of course, libertarians and anarchists, and also, you know, I spoke at the Drug Policy Reform Conference, which was a whole anti-drug, very left-wing, but and they wrote an amicus brief, but of course, all about being against the drug war. So it just depends on the audience, but I think going to the facts, pointing out the big picture is what people can relate to, because then it's like, oh, well, I could be affected here. My kids could be. My grandkids could be.
Helen, you sort of mentioned just skipping over academia and going right to people who want to put your insights into action. Yeah, I think it's easy to be negative always about how things are going. But I wonder if you could give us a dose of optimism, particularly about your work. Are there places where you're seeing people use your insights or sort of even be able to hear things from you that they might not have been able to hear in another context? Again, I'm thinking of the kind of contrast between, you know, the reception of people who try to talk about IQ or gender or a bunch of other now kind of controversial topics in other contexts.
I've never found anybody from the press who objected to my view. It's only in feminist academia that is so resistant of any sort of biological perspective. And they're really fighting the last war. I mean, in Darwin's day, they really did believe that women were inferior. And here comes Helen Fisher saying, geez, women have all these natural talents. Let's use them. And they're still responding with the feeling that, you know, if women are different, then people are going to use that against them. So they're fighting the last war. They're throwing out their own child, really. but in terms of, and the press is, I mean, over and over and over, the press calls me all the time, and they're looking for that anthropological perspective. There's a pile of psychologists all over the place giving a whole lot of good ideas. I've got everything for them. But the biological and the anthropological and the neuroscience perspective is, I think, exceedingly well received. They call me for it. They put it in their articles. I just don't have any problem with anybody except for the group of people who are, you know, terrified of biological determinism. And here's an example of a moment. The phone rang one morning, and I picked it up, and it was somebody from the White House. Well, I said to her, I said, are you calling from a White House or the White House? The White House. She said, well, all right. And anyway, what she wanted to do was use my questionnaire to match foster parents with foster children. And over now, I mean, Deloitte is using it all the time. They don't put my name on it, but they're using it. I mean, I trained them for 18 months. I know it's mine. But I talked to real estate people. I've talked to two groups that all know Trump. And I think that all of these various people are going to be obliged to apply it in their way. I can give them the data. And like with thinking about libertarians, I mean, I spent a lot of time thinking about how I could adapt my lecture to a libertarian group. But I think it will be you who find a way to use this that would be useful to you.
And do you have, when you said I got a call from the White House, I thought the story was going a different place, which was, are there applications in electoral politics or campaigns? Have you ever worked with a with a campaign or a candidate?
I never have, but this is the first political place I've ever been.
It's our apologies.
It's always been business or therapy, because I do a lot on therapists. But it's really expanding. And for example, I'm working with a company now that hires au pairs to work with families. And au pair is a really important thing, because they're around 24/7. I mean, they don't go home. They are home. And so, you know, you're going to match it with the mother, the au pair. You're going to match it with the father, who's probably paying the bill. You're going to match it with the children. You know, I mean, how are you going to use this in different ways? And it's just always a challenge. But somebody came up to me in the break and said, well, you know, maybe we could use it in a political way. In other words, let's say a politician is going to the Midwest to make a speech. He should use different words in the Midwest than he does in the Northeast or in California. He can have exactly the same message, but he can style it differently so the people can hear him. And I think this is the way, the more we know about genetics, the more we know about the way the mind works, the more we can use that in a very positive way to reach people where they can hear you.
And yet that mode of interaction is sometimes vilified. Like, we talk about code switching, we talk about, you know, politicians who, you know, when they speak in their native language, they say one thing, and then when they travel abroad and speak in English, they say something else. Why do you think that practice has a negative reputation, particularly, I think, for politicians? And is that something we should just get over? Or is there also a reason to be suspicious of people who use different words in different places?
Well, I mean, you know, we're a walking billboard of who we are, and we can change the writing on that billboard to reach that audience. And when I was talking with Deloitte, you know, they said exactly what you said. They said, well, you sure I should be changing myself? My opinion is, when in Rome, deal with the Romans. You know, I mean, if you want to be an effective human being in romance, for God's sakes, and with your children and in your job and your community and in your nation and in the world, you're going to have to understand that you're part of a community, and that community is going to hear you in certain ways. And if you, I mean, all science can be used in a bad way, but it can certainly be used to be much more effective in a good way, too.
I like that phrase, if you want to be an effective human being. I think that's what I want. Heidi, can you talk about a case that you're involved with right now, or something specific that your nonprofit maybe is working on that might be of interest to the Reason crew?
Well, for many years, I've been an informal consultant on the case of former death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has been incarcerated for over 30 years, allegedly for shooting a Philadelphia police officer. Now, he had been a radio broadcaster, highly critical of law enforcement, and it turned out he had a very large FBI file on him before the incident in which the police officer was killed. In Philadelphia, he really was a thorn in the side of what had been for a while a corrupt local government and corrupt police force. The Department of Justice actually held them. I think they had a consent decree, and they were called out for one of the precincts was notoriously corrupt. I was interested in the case. I went to law school at Temple in Philadelphia and saw, you know, mention of his name, but he had a huge following, and I learned about it, and I saw that, you know, there were something like 22 constitutional violations in his case. He had poor legal representation, but had a big following by the MOVE family. You may recall that the city dropped a bomb on MOVE, which had an alternative lifestyle in West Philly in the early 80s, I think. And so he inflamed the passions of both sides. And I became interested just because I knew the case. And when I was at the National Lawyers Guild, they were interested in it. So I wrote an amicus brief in that case and started to visit him. He's published 7 books. He's had Desmond Tutu and, you know, scores of other prominent leaders visit him. One of the really most intelligent, well-read individuals I've ever met. And recently it turned out I went to visit him with a friend, and we got to the prison, and they said, well, he's not here. And we ultimately found out he'd collapsed, and he'd been taken to a local health clinic. So we went and tracked him down, guarded by 15 police officers. And the police and the Fraternal Order of Police on their website have a list of people who have supported Mumia over the years. They still call him a cop killer, even though the evidence really points to someone else having shot the officer. It turned out he had hepatitis C. He was gravely ill, and some lawyers in New York who I know represented him and prevailed after a year or two, got him hepatitis C medication, also opening the door for other inmates in Pennsylvania to get treatment. You had to really before wait until the inmate was about to die and the damage had been done. But that was changed. And I continue to be involved in that case because I think it is a clear-cut case of someone who spoke out against a corrupt police department in the media and was very popular. And I think often individuals who become targeted by the government, I've seen this in protest leaders, small movement leaders, they go after the leader or the charismatic person who has the capacity to influence thinking among others. And I think Mumia has that capacity. He has a wildly huge following in France. I help raise money for the case, and we get donations from abroad a lot. They're very progressive. They named a street after him in outside Paris. So that case, and a lot of in my work, we fund an aging a group that works to release aging prisoners. And so I care a lot about prisoners' rights because I think it's a whole strata of our society that is not allowed. They don't have a face on it. And it's until you know an individual like Mumia or others, and now Ross, that you can start to understand the injustices of the criminal justice system and really warehousing a lot of individuals who are considered, as Lynn alluded to, the troublemakers, the ones who can change things.
Lynn, you've talked elsewhere, but I wonder if you'd be willing to elaborate a little bit about you know, I think there's a sort of Ross Central story, but then it's turned out that a lot of the conduct of law enforcement around his case was very problematic. It's probably too nice a word for some of that. Could you talk a little bit, sort of coming off of what Heidi was saying about how we have this sort of strong desire for law enforcement to be, you know, followers of the rules, and that when that isn't true, it's sort of very hard to talk about that and to communicate that story. Can you discuss a couple of the secondary convictions around
absolutely.
Ross's?
I mentioned briefly yesterday there were two. Now they have admitted to being corrupt agents who are now in prison. They were core to the investigation of Silk Road. One of them was a DEA agent. The other one was working for the NSA. And the Secret Service. And they had unfettered access, what one journalist called the keys to the kingdom of the site. And not only did they use that access to steal over $1 million, but they had the ability to change chats, access passwords, change PIN numbers, and even act as Dread Pirate Roberts, the handle of whomever was running the site. And none of this was permitted to be known to the jury. The defense, and that to me is the real crime. There's corrupt federal agents. Yeah, okay, that's bad. They're in jail for not very long, but they're in jail, 6 and 7 years. But the judge would not allow the jury to know that these corrupt agents were all over the site in the investigation. And this was argued in a pretrial hearing and totally precluded and never became public until 2 months later. And since trial, the defense has, one of the things that the government does, I mean, it'd be hours of talking about the shocking, I was shocked, and our lawyer would go, yeah, they do that. You know, he's kind of jaded. And this is our trial lawyer. But since the trial, the defense team kept wading through what was 4 terabytes of material that the government dumped on the defense. And that's like 2.5 billion typewritten pages, I believe, something equivalent to that. You're supposed to wade through to find evidence, and found evidence. And it was reported in Motherboard and in Reason and other places of tampering of probably another corrupt agent, and also of a sign-in of Dread Pirate Roberts into the Silk Road Forum after Ross was already in solitary confinement. So who was that? You know, and there's all these questions that are not permitted to be known. And I always thought going into this, well, yeah, I mean, trials in America, you know, it'll be fair. We'll be able to have our witnesses, which were blocked. We'll be able to really tell our side. And that is not what happens at trial anymore, at least in Ross's. And I remember talking to a defense attorney. He used to be a prosecutor. And he just said, he goes, prosecutors will lie. They will cheat. They will do whatever to get their win. That's what they will do. And now they rule the courtroom. And it's a really serious problem. And it's been, they also often, it's an epidemic, according to Judge Kaczynski in the Ninth Circuit, that they will violate the Brady rule, which is saying you cannot hide exculpatory evidence to, you know, helping the defendant. It's against the law. And they do it all the time. And they did it in Ross's case with these corrupt agents and other things like evidence that there was more than one Dread Pirate Roberts and that it wasn't necessarily Ross running that site. And it goes on and on. And then you can get into the prison system, and that's a whole other nightmare that is kind of like the worst bureaucracy of your nightmares on steroids. It's like the epitome of the horrific bureaucracies that are unaccountable and can pretty much do whatever they want with human lives. So, I've been somewhat, I've had my eyes open to all of this, and it's, as I mentioned yesterday, it's kind of a slippery slope, and I just really see it that we're at a tipping point in history right now, and things are being decided in the courts that are going to impact us all going into the digital age, Ross's case being one of them. And we have a choice. You know, are we going to go towards more innovation and freedom or towards more government intrusion and control? And it's a really pivotal crossroads right now. And I try to get this across to people when I speak, you know, because it's, I mean, you guys all know this, you know, but it's a very important time in history, I think. And that's one of the reasons our criminal justice system is just out of control.
Thank you very much to all of you. I want to leave plenty of time for questions, so we'll get to that. But first, since folks had a chance to take Helen's, if you were got on your phone and had a chance to take Helen's questionnaire, I think she wanted to do a little rundown and at least get a survey of whatever results are available, and we can talk about those during our Q&A here, as well as any questions you have for the panelists. So first of all, let me thank the three of you for joining me up here for the formal portion of our discussion. Thank you very much. And and then Helen, you wanna lead us on a little journey of self-discovery?
Well, first of all, take a look at your logo. It's yellow and red. It's a mixture of yellow and red to make orange. And my hypothesis was, and it was Catherine that noticed that. Anyway, my hypothesis is that, well, first of all, could you raise your hand if you took the questionnaire so we can see what the population is? Okay. And can you raise your hand if you were highest on yellow? Dopamine. Can you raise your hand if you're highest in red? Okay, can you raise your hand if you're highest in blue? One. And can you raise your hand if you're highest in green? Oh, stand up. Are you? So it's all women who are highest in green. Okay. All women who are highest in green. We got only one blue in the room, and the rest of you seem to be red and yellow. So I think I got it right. Shouldn't have been too hard because you're libertarians. Okay.
We were discussing earlier that the yellow as the sort of risk-seeking creative types, that yellow is also the color typically associated with libertarianism, and wondering if Helen fell into that one accidentally, if there's some deeper forces.
No, I studied color. I studied color. And when I applied the four types to their colors, I studied the research on color, and the yellow color is associated with curiosity, creativity, energy, the sun,
and also the Gadsden flag, the Libertarian Party, the anarcho-capitalist black and yellow. So
yeah,
there we go. So I think we are short mics, so I'm going to send mine around, or you can just shout your questions loudly, whichever you prefer. But would anyone like to throw a couple questions out for us?
How can I, as a libertarian woman, talk to other women without turning them off and making them think that perhaps I'm unfeeling, uncaring?
When you talk to a woman who's high green, be contextual. Think long term. Ask them a lot of questions about themselves and their feelings. I got a whole list of things here. Because there certainly are, I think, contextually and long term, balance facts with feelings, give theories and ancillary data. They can go off here and there in the next place. You don't have to focus. You don't have to get straight to the point. Find points of agreement early in the conversation. Appreciate their contributions to show that you care. Mention concerns about people. Reveal your feelings to bond with them. Sit facing them and do what's called the anchoring gaze. Do not be competitive or confrontational. They don't like it, people who are aggressive or blunt. They don't like people who are impersonal or aloof. They don't like people who interrupt. Women have a different conversational style than men do. Samuel Johnson once said, every good conversation is a series of interruptions. Women don't agree with that. We wait very politely for one person to finish, and then we go. So it's like this and that. Don't push for a decision before they've explored all of the options. And never forget that they have meaning in everything. And you know you're in trouble when they begin to placate or when they become reluctant. Now, I could easily go through all four of them, but that's if you think the woman is very green, very high estrogen. If she's high dopamine, you're going to immediately feel. What's interesting with me is because before I studied this, there's some people that instantly I feel a rapport with them. Instantly I feel a rapport, and I'm almost assuming, okay, they're going to be high dopamine like me and high estrogen with me. When I'm around a high serotonin person, I almost feel a tenseness. It feels like I got to work on it to be the right kind of person to, and so you would almost even feel your own body to see how you might deal with them. If you're around a high serotonin person, which is going to be quite the opposite of the libertarian, stick to the concrete. Be orderly and calm, stick to schedules and plans, emphasize the right way of doing things, you gotta use those kinds of words, accentuate tradition, minimize the risks and uncertainties, and give them the details, 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 details. And you know that you're in trouble if they begin to ask too many questions about the details or if they withdraw. But never present an unsubstantiated point of view. For example, I would never say to a high serotonin person, well, you know, I got a sort of this theory that maybe, da-da-da. No, no, no. The world is round. Leave it at that. Don't go for any kind of unfounded theories. Don't use intuitive statements like, I suspect. Don't exaggerate. They like it absolutely concrete. Don't leave things unresolved. Now, for example, in a meeting, if I'm in a meeting with high serotonin people and we haven't solved what we're going to solve today, I will say, well, we haven't solved this today, but tomorrow when we meet, we're going to do this first. We're going to get it done within the next 10 minutes. You're going to write the memo on it, and then we'll move on to what's next. Concretize everything and never be unorganized. So once you begin to understand these styles, then you can really begin to operate within their parameters.
I just want to add, I think that in general, women I know care about their children, their grandchildren. If they don't have children, they have empathy towards others and children often. And I think, you know, what I've done is said, I don't want my kids or your kids to live in a surveillance state. I don't, you know, I would want freedom for them. I would want choices for them, and kind of bring it home to what kind of future do you want for your kids? Because that's what we're really looking at here. And it's, to me, it's kind of astounding that people think libertarians are cold-hearted, because to me, that's, it's a very compassionate philosophy. But I don't know what type that makes me, but anyway, I'd say, you know, get it personal and saying, what do you want for your children? And that's another suggestion. That's what I do.
Question. I have the microphone. I'm John Utley with the American Conservative Magazine. For Ms. Ulbricht, or Mrs., excuse me, you mentioned your son was put in solitary confinement. Can you elaborate a bit? Are there charges? Can any guard push them in? And I donate to a group called Solitary Watch, which has, you know, these horrendous stories. It's the most unpleasant subject. But and speaking, since it's women and men, I never hear women in solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. It's usually men put in. But can you elaborate on what you know a bit about that?
Sure. Well,
Solitary Watch, as I say, I'd recommend. Also,
yeah, I mean,
as a site on this,
it's been proven to be torture, plain and simple. Ross's case, he had no explanation. He was put in solitary confinement initially for 6 weeks, which some people are in there for years. So he's, thank God, he wasn't in there for longer. But at the same time, he said it was really tough, and he's described that experience. It's terrifying. It messes with your mental health. And so it's kind of routine, I think. And they gave no explanation. I'm like, why is he in solitary confinement? No explanation. And that shows they can do what they want once you're in prison. So in his case, it wasn't hugely long, but a month and a half in solitary is pretty long. And it's a terrible thing that we do this in our country, and sometimes for years at a time, and destroy people. And Ross has met people in prison who have been mentally, permanently, you know, damaged very badly by solitary confinement.
And often, as I mentioned earlier, people who are perceived as leaders are put in solitary. There's also a unit called a CMU, Communications Management Unit, that a few maximum security facilities have, where they totally isolate you without any reason, but it's usually leaders. You're isolated from any outside communication. And as Lynn said, Juan Mendez, the special rapporteur for torture for the UN years ago, did say, after a certain number of days, solitary is torture. It's sort of like being locked in a windowless bathroom.
I love these names they have too, like, you know, communications unit. The people that decide where you go in the prison system, they're called the hotel team. I'm like, oh, okay, the most evil and expensive hotel in the world. But they have these euphemisms that are really pretty amazing.
I just want to note also that, I'm not sure if I'm on, that Elizabeth Nolan Brown at Reason recently did a piece about women who had been put in solitary. So it does happen. The Santa Rita jail in California, there was a federal lawsuit against it. And they found a bunch of things, including, you know, shackled pregnant women and some other things. But women in solitary, it does happen. And on that absolutely horrific note. Thank you so much for joining the lady panel. We hope that you've become far more compassionate and enlightened and warm and fuzzy because of it. And Preston's going to march us out for lunch or something. Go ahead, Preston.